Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking
recording
information,
in progress,
opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, welcome, everybody. If this is, we seem to have a little of a recording.
We're going. Chuck Bonneville, Julie Hayden here.
Well, I can say that, Julie. Chuck Bonneville, Julie Hayden, True Straight Up here on a Wednesday hump day, brought to you by
AmericaCitizenPress.com, a great website for conservative voices. Also by Julie McCallan, Dr. Julie McCallan, and Denver Cenogenics. Lots to talk about today. We've got Eric Felton, who's got a great column in Real Clear Investigations, Real Clear Politics, one of my favorite websites of all. It gives you both sides, really, on pretty much any topic, and they have specific categories, but he's got a great one on really essentially the true origins of critical race theory. We'll get to him in a second. And then Vicky Tonkin's coming up about the Colorado, the El Paso County dinner coming up this weekend with Mark.
Featuring Green.
Yeah.
We're going down. Everybody's going down to El Paso this Friday.
And liberal heads are exploding.
And establishment heads are exploding in the Republican Party because they don't like Marjorie Greene. So it's a lot of fun.
That's right. And real quick, before we get to Eric, I see Mark Poff is there on, I think that's Mark, on Zoom. Want to thank him for filling in for us Monday. He always does a great job.
Yeah.
So let's just jump right to it. Our guest starting off is Eric Felton. Hey, Eric, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing, Julie?
We're very good. Before we get into your column, you want to tell folks, because it's the first time we've had you on the show. A little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, let's see. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, originally. So I'm a fellow Westerner and moved out to some 30 years ago to Washington, D.C. to be a political writer. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
All right. Well, let me start off with, we have a 10-year-old son, Chuck and I do, who's in elementary school, going into fifth grade. And I have a grown-up daughter. And we were talking with her just before going on the show. And I said, yeah, we're going to have Eric Felton on talking about critical race theory. And she's like, what is that? And I'm like, and Eric,
good
doing,
question.
Maybe why don't I get you to start off when you're talking about in your column or your article about critical race theory? I mean, why don't you start off by kind of laying a groundwork for what you're sort of talking about and then get into, which I think is fascinating, some of the origins, really.
Sure. Critical race theory comes down to basically a rejection of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Some ambitious academics, law school professors and students who are Black, decided that the civil rights movement had sort of lost its energy and was exhausted. And so they proceeded to pursue an ideological project that the whole point of which was to reject and cast aside the things that had been seen as great achievements of the civil rights era, things like colorblindness, things like thinking of people as individuals with rights who look to the courts to protect those rights. Instead, they pursued an agenda that was basically pushing for segregation, against integration, against assimilation, calling assimilation of the races killing off of races.
Yeah,
right.
Races. Genocide. Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's kind of, if we can pick on that a little bit, not pick on it, but sort of look into it, because I think if you're the average person, and I'm a parent, sort of like me, you would think that on one hand, critical race theory is sort of just an extreme part of the Civil Rights Act, but the way you explained it really brings a lot of things into focus. What it's saying is, no, Civil Rights Act is not what we want. We don't want colorblindness. We don't want everyone to be equal. Things us silly parents have been teaching our kids for decades. They're like, no, that's not what we want. That's not what we're after at all, right? I mean, so people, I think people need to understand just how different this is from what they might think that it is.
Right. And if you think about if your agenda is to separate people, how better to do it than to get people sort of upset with one another? I mean, I think one of the things that a lot of parents have been baffled by is why would schools have anything to do with teaching an agenda that puts students sort of at odds with one another, which encourages dislike of one another. And if you think about it, if your goal as the
what did we lose him? Okay, he dropped off the line. Hey, can we maybe go ahead and call him back? Okay, good. They're going to call him back again. Well, I think when I was reading his column, and again, I recommend everybody go. It's Eric Felten, F-E-L-T-E-N. Go to realclearpolitics.com, and then you go to, there's a little header where it says investigations. Go there. When I was reading it, I'm like, this makes sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. The idea doesn't make sense to me, but the where they're coming from all of a sudden, it is much more extreme, isn't even the right word, because it's not extreme. It's not like an extreme Civil Rights Act. Well, it's something completely different, really.
It's like everything else. It's just a warmed over, somewhat dissolute version of Marxism. Marxism says there's classes, and there's the rich and the poor, the proletariat, and the rich oppress the poor. All the laws are really just made so that the poor can't get a chance, that all the societal structures are really there to make sure that the rich stay on top of the food chain and the poor stay on the bottom. And this just substitutes race, that everything we do in our laws, in schools,
education,
you know, meritocracy, individualism, everything else is a social construct. And therefore math, for example, is a one blacks do poorly in, and therefore we shouldn't force them to be judged by that. You shouldn't have SATs on math. You shouldn't really have anything in which Derek Bell and his feel inferior about, and that the whole society, everything, every part of it is racist, and that there's an oppressor class and there's an oppressed class, and the oppressor class is white instead of wealth, which is in Marxism. But I think we've got our guest back.
Eric back. Hey, Eric, they're censoring us, I guess. Thank you for...
I just got canceled, I think. So.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, well, we know how that feels. Well, and one of the things you talk about in your column is that although this is getting a lot, I have a two-part question. One is, it seems to me this has been going on a lot longer than people realize, this theory. Part A, and can you explain that? And then part B is, why has it all of a sudden come to a forefront now?
Well, I think if we could, you know, if we talk a little bit about how it got started,
right.
It was born of a radical movement in the late 70s called Critical Legal Studies. And Critical Legal Studies was a movement at Harvard and a few other elite law schools to basically push the notion that the law is nothing but power politics in judges' robes, and that you could sort of make the law whatever you wanted to make it by exerting enough power and influence. And so they sort of had a radical agenda, and there were several African-American students and professors who were part of this movement, but not that many. But the critical legal studies folk thought that the crits, as they were called, believed that the crits of color, as they called themselves, were allies in this sort of radical agenda they had, until they had a conference at Pine Manor College in 1986, in the summer of 1986, and they did some workshops where they wanted to talk about race issues and handed the time over to the Crits of Color, who were their allies in this sort of radical agenda. And the Crits found themselves right from the get-go at this workshop being dressed down for being themselves racists and for not making enough opportunities for the Crits of Color to have leadership roles in the Crits organization. And in one of the books about the beginning of critical race theory, written by a couple of people who were part of that, such as Kimberly Crenshaw, they talk sort of gleefully about how the Crits, the white students at these prestigious law schools, were driven to hand-wringing hysteria by being accused of racism. And so this radical movement broke off into mostly the white Crits went their way, and the critical race theory crew were born of this sort of splintering of this radical group. And so the African-American students went off and became the critical race theory students group. And they were praised from early on by Cornel West as being pursuing a powerful ideological movement. And the critical race theory people at the law schools talked about how great law schools were as a place to begin indoctrination. They actually used the word indoctrination for talking about, you know, the positions they took up in law schools where they would, you know, begin pursuing an agenda that here now some 30 plus years later has really sort of come to fruition.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to law school in the early 70s, and certainly there is a movement in the 1930s that is similar to critical studies. And I guess in many ways, I don't disagree with it. It basically says, you know, there's always two sets of laws that you can apply to. You can look at something and say, well, we'll look at the exact meaning of it and we'll do this. Or you can say, no, let's go to the intent. And there's always a contrary theory to everything. And so a judge is not some kind of scientist looking through a tube at what's objective reality, but just reflecting his own biases. And in a lot of ways, I think that's absolutely true. People ask you, well, is this law constitutional or not? And you go, well, who's going to be deciding?
Depends on the judge.
It depends on the judge. You know, you look at 5-4 decisions where five conservative justices think one way and four liberals think the other way, and they all have their cases and their strict scrutiny backgrounds and everything else to it. So that made a lot of sense to me in some ways. Critical race theory seems, you know, kind of poor Marxism slopped over to attack really everything, anything.
Right. What's their end game here?
Yeah. Well, their end game is destruction of society, as the left's always been. But it's kind of like, oh, no, we can't have math. We can't have science. Anything that makes Derek Bell feel inferior is a structural racism. But they've been very successful in kowtowing the whites who used to.
The hand wringing.
Yeah. It's been.
Yeah.
Those are the.
I think the thing that's so discouraging about it is that you take what was one of the great ethical triumphs of our society, which is the civil rights movement, and you take the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King and abandon that. It's such a shame, and it not only sort of hurtful for kids in school, but you know, it ends up being hurtful for relationships that people have grown up and out in the real world, when we should be finding ways to be, you know, positive with one another and friends with one another. And, you know, you have this, if there's anything that's systemic, it's an effort to put people at odds with each other, to cause you know, dislike and distress. And it just seems to me a terrible shame and something that one ought to fight against on the principle that that people should all get along, and you know,
right.
Our society hasn't been perfect, but we can do what we can to improve it, and to improve the relations that that people have with one another, rather than look for new ways to cast aside the progress that has been made.
Well, and you're right. I mean, that's the thing. Like I said, it's not really an extreme version of the civil rights movement. It's the exact opposite. As I understand it from listening to you talking about the history and the things that I've learned, they're not trying to get to a colorblind equality thing. They're saying that's impossible. But what is it that they want? I mean, so let's just say we teach this. Do they want us to destroy everything? Do they just want two completely different sets of rules? I mean, what's their goal?
Well, the goal is color consciousness instead of color blindness. And by color consciousness, the goal is to see everything, whether it's history, whether it's economics, whether it's sociology, to see everything through a lens of race. And so whereas the civil rights movement was about color blindness, the notion that, you know, maybe an inescapable thing, maybe an impossible thing, but something to strive for, that we see people for who they are, for the content of their character, not the color of their skin. You know, that being the core principle of the civil rights movement, the core principle of the critical race theory movement has been to see everything and everyone in terms of color rather than in terms of their character.
The only criticism of critical race theory seems to come from the white right,
and the conservatives. Why are the white people concerned about this?
And not the people who claim that, you know, they're the ones who did the civil rights movement. They're the ones who marched in the marches and everything else. They seem to have surrendered to the critical race theory without even much of a fight.
Well, but you know, there is an effort to, you know, silence anyone who would speak out, and the critical race theory movement has succeeded in silencing and scaring off not only a lot of critics who would naturally respond negatively to this from the right, and have done so also with people in the African American community, but there are some exceptions. If you get a chance to see a podcast or read something by Glenn Lowry, he is used to be a professor at Harvard and is now at Brown University, and he has been powerful in arguing against the principles of the critical race theory movement, and he gets a lot of grief for it.
Is he an African American?
He's got the courage, and he's African American.
Yeah. Well, where's the white? Where are the white liberals? Economists. Where's our beloved white liberals that really helped lead this civil rights movement? Where are all they? Can you name one powerful white liberal that is arguing against it?
You know, I don't know about whether he's powerful or not, but. A commentator, Andrew Sullivan, he's sort of taken a lead as somebody who is a sort of what you would call a classical liberal,
He used to be a classical conservative, but then he became a classical liberal.
Well, let me ask you this. We're talking with Eric Felton about his great column up at Real Clear Investigations. So based on what you talked about in the history and things, so when we saw, as we've seen this past year, where if you're a Trump supporter, you're being imprisoned after January 6th without bail, but if you are looting and you're African-American and you're looting stores and rioting, burning things down, it's not just, and that's okay, under this critical race theory, it's not really hypocrisy that we're seeing. I mean, we will say, see, look, they're hypocritical. But under the critical race theory, am I right? That's just the way it should be, right? It's like, it's not hypocritical. It's like, no, if you're white and you riot, then you go to jail.
You have no right
But if you're black and you riot, if
you have a right to.
You have a right to. Or the same thing, if you're black and you get a bond set and that keeps you in prison, that's all right. But if you're black, but if you're black, then you should be released in a personal recognizance bond no matter what. And I mean, is that sort of how we're seeing this play out sort of like in a real life world?
Well, I think that it is part of what critical race theory is about is, again, everything is color conscious. Everything is seen in terms of color. So they would not say that or admit or agree to the idea that there was anything hypocritical about their stance, because they're not saying that people should all be treated equally. They're saying people should be treated based on their race, what their race is. A lot of the energy for the critical race theory movement came after two events. One was the Supreme Court's Bakke decision, which put limits on affirmative action. And the other was an effort to get more black professors hired at Harvard Law School. And so part of what they were rejecting was this notion that you would have people getting jobs or education based on their merits as opposed to on the basis of their color. And the critical race theory movement has been explicit from the beginning that that they see that they reject the notion that there can be any kind of reverse racism, and that that indeed, as long as you see things from the point of view of color to begin with, that you're not being hypocritical at all. You're following your principles.
How did this end up? How did it get from where you're talking about and to basically being in elementary schools in Douglas and Jefferson County, Colorado? Mm-hmm. How did we get there?
Well, you know, you begin with law schools, and then other academics pick up on the principles and take it into the education school, and there they are taught to apply those principles in their actual classrooms, and so you have a sort of systemic, if I might use that word, effort at indoctrination that sort of moves down from academia through teachers being indoctrinated at their teacher's college or university. And then you end up with things like in California, there's a minority teaching curriculum that instructs teachers to be up to speed on critical race theory and to use it in their classrooms. So, you know, the one thing that you can say about the left is that they don't look just short term.
No.
Sort of left-wing movements, they play the long game.
Well, and now they're being funded. Now they're getting all the government grants and things too, right? We've got this one I was talking about in Douglas County. This one or group they call it equity theory, but it's the same thing. And they're getting paid something like $37,000. That was a grant, right? Of our tax dollars at some point, though, to instruct the teachers. So you're right. The left, they do a really good job of they set this up, then they get the money, then they funnel it back to the organizations, and nobody wants to stop
it. It seems to be the long term. You've got two possible outcomes. Mm-hmm. One is you have like Rwanda, where the 10%, which were the Tutsis, really ran the country over the 90%, which were the Hutus. And here it'll be black domination of all of the organs of power in order to make up for centuries of oppression. Or you resegregate society and blacks and whites square off and they have a resegregated society. I don't see where critical race theory has any other logical outcome than those two. Do you?
Well, and when you put it that way, it does just make one think about, you know, how much progress has been made in this country over race, and how much more needs to be made. But it needs to be made by people coming together, not being at odds with each other. And, you know, we need the kind of principles that motivated the civil rights movement, which were a sort of respect for one another and the notion of finding connections with one another rather than looking for ways of tearing
ourselves apart. But assuming
that's
not what critical race...
Yeah, but they don't want to do that.
Assuming that critical race theory does not believe in any of those, where does critical race theory go other than the two outcomes that I've articulated?
Or do parents just fight it, that it goes away?
No. But under the critical race theory doctrine, if they got to where they wanted to go, what would it be? And I've laid out two: resegregation or a domination of black over whites in reparations for centuries of discrimination. There's no other place for critical race theory to go.
Well, they can't
there?
Let them win, then, I guess.
Well, I'm asking him the question, though, and I'd like him to answer it. Where do they see America 40 years from now if they are successful?
You know, I do think that critical race theory would be very happy to have, you know, some kind of apartheid-like regime in this country in which, you know, different racial communities stayed separate. And, you know, it's really such a horrible notion and horrible that such a notion is being put forward in this day and age, and being celebrated as somehow, you know, the serious moral position, when it's quite the opposite.
Yeah. Right. Hey, Eric, we've run out of time. You know, your article just explained a lot about what it was. And again, that it is not, you just did a great job explaining, this is not the civil rights movement that people think it is.
It's so, a contra.
Yeah. So what, just real quick, where can people read some other stuff that you've written? Are you working on anything in particular you want us to keep an eye out for?
Well, I can always, promote my last book, which was a book called Loyalty, The Vexing Virtue, about how all the relationships we have in life are defined ultimately by loyalties we have to one another, but those loyalties come into conflict, and that can drive us a little bonkers at times. So I think it's an interesting topic, and
absolutely.
Some of your listeners might want to check that out.
That sounds great. That sounds wonderful.
And they can get it anywhere books are sold, I imagine, right?
Well, pretty much, yeah. I think you have to go to Amazon these days. It's been a few years since it was in bookstores. So.
That's right. Eric, thank you for your
time. Thank you, Eric.
We'd love to have you back anytime you have something great. So thank you, please stay in touch, okay?
Will do. Thanks so much. It was nice to meet you.
All right. Take care.
Eric Felton there. I really do recommend folks read that. We've got some comments now. But I mean, to me, it kind of explained it. And it explained, it's not what, you know, your little soccer mom in the suburbs thinks it is. It's exact, like you said, the exact opposite. This is from Karen Cataline. And Karen, I'm sorry, I didn't see it in time because I have to put my glasses on. Could you ask him if all of this isn't just a ploy to bring about full-out communism by advancing collectivism? So then Charlene says, end result, chaos and class envy to keep us divided and conquered so the powerful can keep their power. And then Jim Jackson says, CRT is just the racism seen in the South before the Civil War inverted. Both are evil and need to be eradicated. You know, I would say this, I'm not so sure, Chuck, and we're waiting to get Vicky Tompkins on here in a few minutes. It seems to me, I don't know, is it communism they want or is it just power they want? Like you said, where they just want to be...
Well, same thing. I mean, communists wanted power for themselves based on a doctrine.
But I think
critical race theory wants power for the intelligent, black intelligence.
Right, yeah, they don't want it for Candace Owens or Casper Stockham people like that.
And as I said, you have to look, which is never explored, of where is the world they want to go to?
Right.
Where is everything turns out the way they want it to? Where would it go to? And it's either a black-dominated intelligentsia state where they dominate everything in sort of reverse of what's happened for the last couple hundred years and reparations for it. Or it's you divide the country between black and white and, I don't know, probably Asian and everything else also.
Am I right? Critical race theory, though, the only minority that matters is the black African-Americans, right?
Well, Asians, but there's critical Asian theory. There's critical Hispanic theory.
I think Charlene hits it on the head here, too. I think that underneath everything, you cannot throw out just plain old, good old basic human greed, where she said communism is the easiest way to transfer wealth. Look at what's going on with the Black Lives Matter people, where the money goes in and they're buying mansions and that's not trickling down. I think that it's kind of all of the above. I think you've got greed combined with ideology. And I think that here's where I would agree with Karen Cataline a little bit too. And then you have the liberals. They just want to divide us so they can conquer us. They don't care what the method is. It can be whatever.
But as he explained in that, that college meeting back in whatever year it was, it's a divide between the white liberals and the black liberals.
Right.
Except the blacks are no longer liberals, they're crits. And so you have just a war between those two, but with the white liberals just sort of bowing down and disappearing in the wrong way.
Except their parents are getting up in arms.
All right.
Now we have one of our heroes, Vicky Tompkins, with the El Paso County Republican Party, the chairperson of the El Paso County Republican Party. Hey, can you unmute your microphone? Are you muted?
I think I did.
There she is. Okay, so I was reading, I was kind of Googling information, which why I use Google, I don't know, about this event. And I kept coming up with Ian Silveri's column, which made me happy because he's a very progressive nut job, I would say.
The husband of
Brittany Patterson, who wants safe injection sites. Why the Denver Post even publishes his columns, it's like...
Well, because they're no better.
Well, all right. But his head is exploding. And if nothing else, this event, and he's like, we'll see if anyone even goes to the event. Well, from what we understand, you guys got to get out like big IMAX screens or something for the outside. Now there's so many people going there.
Well,
just,
tell us about the event.
This is great. All right, I'm sorry.
Well, it's our annual Lincoln Day dinner. We were not able to have a Lincoln Day dinner last year because of the COVID issue. Mm-hmm. So this is a big deal for us this year. It's the first one that I have actually done as chair because the one we did in 2019 was left to me 10 days before. So this is something I get to do from the beginning. I got to tell you, it's pretty popular.
I know we're having to turn our suite into like the party hospitality suite.
And we're broadcasting.
Save me some space.
All right.
We're broadcasting live from the hotel on Friday where the event's being done. And so how many can you squeeze in at the hotel?
Listen, we have the second largest room in the building. And it's not big enough. So we have a waiting list of well over 50 people. We're pushing 60 people just on the waiting list.
Wow.
And they're just not going to get in. It's so sad.
No.
We could have easily filled 500 to 600.
Wow.
But we had to limit it to 420. And that's more than what they had originally given me. So I asked for, please give me some more tables. And so we were able to work it out. And so we can, that's our max. And I tried to get two more tables and they're like, no way.
we can dress in fireman outfits and pretend we're there to monitor the crowd
As I understand, your predecessor, which the establishment drove out, tried to have a dinner and then, whether
that was
it's the Southers or whether it's the, Eli Bremer and the Bremers and all of the establishment ones who are incredibly vicious people. They all said, okay, try to have a Lincoln Day event. We're not coming. And therefore it'll fail. So you certainly showed them.
Well, you know what? Here's the deal. People want to participate. People want to be a part. And what has happened in El Paso County for many years is if you're not a part of the club, if you're not a part of the elite, if you're not a part of those who have been doing this for 20 or 30 years, you're always told to wait your turn. Well, people are done with that. And so I think they saw an opportunity to be a part of something bigger than themselves and wanted to be there. And I mean, the first person that bought a table bought a platinum table. He's like, we're going to fill this thing. And 2 weeks before the event, we're sold out.
Yeah. I mean, it's now, but now Ian Silveri was suggesting we needed people like Mitt Romney to be there, that he might be able.
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to. He was like, they're not going to be able to sell it out. They need to go back to the days when they had Mitt Romney there. I'm like, oh, that'll sell it out. That'll sell it out.
Well, the reason I had a reason for my laughter, because when people have said, why did you pick Marjorie Taylor Greene of all people? Right. I said, who would you have chosen? Mitt Romney? That's why I laughed.
Well, here's what I think. A couple of things I want to say and maybe get your thoughts on. Number one, you know, sort of uniformly attacked by this in the, you know, Colorado politics of places like that, where they repeat all of the debunked things about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and they all go off on their whole QAnon thing again, which, I mean, that's just so ridiculous to anyone who actually knows what they're talking about. And they're just so ignorant. It drives me crazy to see my fellow former colleagues just so ignorant
let me finish this. Let me ask you, this is obviously a tremendously popular event. You'd think the Colorado Republican Party would be just celebrating and so thrilled to see a Lincoln Day dinner. That's making a lot of money. You know, so what table is Chrissy Burton Brown sitting at?
Christy has a previous engagement.
Okay. We thought she might. You know, this ties into what I was going to say.
I love Christy.
Yeah, I bet.
She's busy.
Know, and one of the things I said to Christy, we all make our choices. I'm good.
Yeah. You would just think, I mean, I'm sorry, if you're trying to, why would people not want to, maybe you don't like what she has to say. Maybe you disagree with some of it. Why on earth, what is happening in our society where we feel like we have to cancel everyone we don't agree with? What's wrong with going and listening to her and saying, hey, she's pretty good, or saying, hey, you know, I don't know what the big deal is. What, right. And for you to host an event with a person that you know is going to pack the house, that should be for what your job is, not only to share ideas, but to, you know, help support your party. I'm surprised that the party leadership isn't saying, you go, girl, you know, good for you for doing this.
Well, you would think that, but they haven't said that since I've been in office. So I don't.
Oh, there you go.
So we had our executive committee meeting last night. Sorry about the phone ring.
It's okay.
It's been crazy. But we had our executive committee meeting on Monday. Is today Tuesday?
Wednesday.
On Monday. And it was so funny. We had a very short agenda because, of course, we're working on getting everything ready for the Lincoln Day dinner. And at the end, I did not have it on the agenda, but someone said, well, are you going to tell us about the Lincoln Day dinner? And I had already gaveled everything out. And I said, sure. So I started sharing what was happening, our wait list and everything, and how it's going to be packed. Everybody's going to get to know each other really well because it's going to be so packed in the room. And those who support me were excited and clapping, and the others were not. And so,
I got to go down. We went down and the chairwoman was kind enough to have our opt-out group in for their executive committee member meeting, and it was just jam-packed, including lots of the establishment people. Wayne Williams was there, Lois Landgraf was there, and other ones, you know, aching for a fight. But Chairman Tompkins just did a great job being fair, being equitable, but standing your ground. And so I really want to praise you, because I said, well, that's not easy. Because that room was packed. I mean, it was packed.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
Well, the interesting thing is that is happening with our Lincoln Day dinner, I've never seen so many elected officials that are going to be out of town at the same time. I had one come in my office, and he was talking about, he didn't know I was in my office with my door open, and he was out in the foyer talking to our treasurer. The treasurer's like, hey, have you gotten your ticket for the Lincoln Day dinner yet? And he goes, Well, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm just not sure. You know, she's anti-Semite. Da, 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 da.
Oh, good grief.
And I'm thinking, wow, I didn't say a word. I just listened. And so I emailed him a little later. I said, man, I'm sorry you're not coming to the Lincoln Day dinner. Wish you could be here, blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, I have to be out of town, blah, blah, blah.
Well, is Mayor Suthers coming?
No.
Okay, so here's, yeah.
Somebody, how about former Secretary of State Wayne Williams?
No.
And this is from Charlene. She's saying Chrissy Burton Brown and Ken Buck are having a pity party together. So here's the thing again, that I just would, you know, for a long time as Republicans, we have supported and gone to dinners that had people that maybe we weren't the biggest fans of, but exactly. We knew that if it packed the door and you know, and so it's, but I don't pack the room rather. I don't understand why, if you're an elected official, you don't think to yourself, geez, all of my constituents are going to this dinner. Maybe I'm out of step here. Maybe I'm missing something. Maybe, you know, I'm worried about what some liberal reporter in some newspaper that no one even reads anymore is going to criticize me and repeat a whole bunch of lies about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know. They got their priorities wrong.
And here's the thing. I didn't know a whole lot about her. I had seen her. I really liked what I did hear. So, of course, I do my research. I went out and I listened to just about every video I could find, every article I could find. Oh, man, they really come against this woman. Oh, yeah, we're getting her. I mean, you know, because she's doing something. She's right. Not just sitting back, just doing the typical, oh, well, you know, we're Republicans and you know, we're the minority. And well, you know, we can't really do anything. And, well, you know, come on, the woman's doing something. She's right. Making a difference.
Oh, hello. Hi. Hi.
Cheryl's well, working hard over here.
Here's the thing. It's like, driver.
I am not.
What'd you say?
She's a slave driver. Yeah.
But I mean, we are just so excited and to see these elected officials just behave the way they are. I'm like, come on, you guys. I was there at Lincoln Day dinners and support you guys, mm-hmm. buying tables, trying to get people out to support you. Really?
Right.
Your people that will work for you and vote for you are going to be there, and you're missing a golden opportunity.
Exactly. Exactly.
I tell you, Peter Boyles articulated it beautifully the other day on the show. He said, you don't need to worry about the grassroots. So they'll vote for you anyway. So, you know, never
not
have
anymore,
that. You know,
no.
You know, they'll come along no matter what you do. And I have found out in Colorado politics that it's one of two rules. If the establishment is on top and it gets its candidate elected or nominated, then it's all unite. You people all have to join up. You all have to come in. You all have to help out.
Yes,
if,
right.
If a conservative wins, if a grassroots person, they withdraw their money, they withdraw their support, they go way off, they all say they're out of town, they've got a previous engagement and everything else. And the Republican Party could unify if sometimes the grassroots won and the establishment supported that. Sometimes the establishment wins and then the grassroots support that. But it's a one-way support machine.
Yes.
And it's just so sad to watch them. And this dinner, it's going to be a celebration of grassroots. I mean, because we won't.
Thank you for saying it. Thank you for saying it. That's exactly what it's going to be. I have been saying that here in the office. This is going to be a grassroots party.
Yes.
We are ready to party. We've been stuck in our homes. We've been told to wear a mask. We've been told to do all this crazy, ridiculous stuff, which, by the way, I don't do. And we are ready to party. We're ready to be with like-minded people and party, to listen to a person who is there, who is fighting the fight every single day for us, who are forcing those who have been lazy and not doing their jobs in Washington, D.C., to actually show what they're doing.
Yes.
She is causing these people to have to show their vote and not hide behind a yes or a no.
Exactly.
And so I'm really excited about, I'm excited to hear her. what the best you know, has to say.
And here's the thing they would go see. I mean, look on the left side. I mean, why do we have cowardly Republican leaders who are so worried about what some stupid reporter is going to say? You got Andrew Cuomo has been like indicted with this and no one cares. We've got a president who gets a note handed to him. So you've got something on your chin. He wipes it off and eats it. And that's all okay. And we can support those people. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, hey, we're going to pull some comments she made completely out of context.
Well, there's no,
and we can't show up there.
There's nobody who's more popular in the Republican Party and grassroots than Lauren Boebert. She just, yes. She just is. Everybody loves her. And yep. that contradicts the Peter Boyle. So, oh, we got to move to the middle. We've got to be more like Democrats. We've mm-hmm. got to be. We got
the Democrats are not in the middle. There's no middle.
No, I know. We got to be more like AOC, and
that's such a bunch of baloney. I'm sorry.
Yes,
but
yes.
This is my biggest struggle here. It's like you were saying, if a not grassroots person is in position, everybody come together. Let's do this together. Let's pull together. Come on, let's work. Grassroots person's in there. Hope y'all are having fun.
Yeah.
We'll see you later.
Yeah.
We're not giving you any money.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Now here's the interesting part. Everybody's starting to see it.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a secret.
Yeah. Yes.
It's no longer a secret.
Yes.
That's right. Everybody is seeing it now and they're like, enough. Now I'm gonna say something that may be a little shocker to everyone. There will never be unity in the Republican Party as long as there are individuals who only think of themselves, power, control, and money. There will never be unity as long as you have those people in the Republican Party. And that's what I see all the time. It is not about serving people. It is not about doing what our founding fathers initially wanted us to do as servant leaders. There's too many in the Republican Party who is all about themselves, raising money for their pockets, raising money for their children, raising money for whatever they want to waste it on, and not thinking about the people they're supposed to be serving. Until there is a shift in people's thinking about what elected officials are supposed to be, and that is servant leaders, we will never have unity.
I agree totally. Yeah. And I think if you wanted to go and figure out, well, who are the individuals that are just about money, just about themselves, just about power, all you need to do is go to the LEAP initiative, Initiative 25, and see who the supporters of that are.
And because none of them are coming to your dinner.
Yeah, and none of those people, I bet you not exactly. A single one of those people are coming to dinner. Because all they care about is eating off the table scraps to the Democrats.
Yep.
They, all they care about is the Democrats will give them 10% to the Rhino Republicans while they gorge on 90% and run everything. But the Rhino Republicans who signed on to that, like former Governor Owens, Christy Burton Brown, and many others in that, they are just looking for the table scraps of the Democrats. And
no, thank you.
Yeah.
And here's what's good is, and that's why we wanted to have you on. This is why we're going to be here. What you have proven, Vicky, is that what you have proven is we don't need them. That's fine. Right? You guys, you don't want to be there? We can pack the place and then some without your help, because there are, sort of like with the Trumping, there are more of us than there are of you.
Yes. And here's the great part. As we look through some of the names of the people who are coming, I would venture to say more than half of those who are coming have never attended a Lincoln Day dinner.
Really?
Wow.
They are stoked. They are so excited. And that's what I want to do. I want to bring in those people who have stayed out on the fringes and said, you know what? I don't like the Republican Party and what they're doing. I'm going to vote well, but I just don't like what they're doing. These people are emailing me saying, I'm coming to hear Marjorie Taylor Greene just because of what they're doing to you. And I'm like, Great. Come on and join the party.
There you go. Well, we would ask you to promote it, but you can't. It's like people can't come.
I know. If I put you on the waiting list, I'm so sorry. You're just not going to make it.
Is it going to be live streamed or anything like that? Or can we? That's
You know, I haven't thought about that. Yeah. I might have to see if we can put that together.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great?
It's hard to do with that kind of venue, but.
No, yeah, it is. I mean, we're going to have cameras there, you know, videotaping everything. And we'll be probably doing a press release afterwards, just telling about some of the things that happened. And oh, bring your checkbooks, bring your credit cards. If you are on the list to be there, because we have some auction items that are absolutely amazing.
Oh,
and this is something else that we've never done. I'm so excited about this. We're going to have a professional auctioneer.
Yeah,
with the whole language thing that they do, you know?
That's very cool. They talk faster than I do even. So.
I know. So that's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be great. We have so many things that people have contributed in our community. It's amazing. So bring those checkbooks. You know this is a fundraiser, ours. So you got to buy something.
All right.
We'll bring them. Well, the wonderful part is I have a feeling this will be the El Paso County Republican Party will have more monies in its coffers after the event than it's ever had.
That's the plan.
All right. Thank you, Vicki. We appreciate it.
Take
it.
I appreciate your support. I appreciate you asking me to come on and being able to share what's happening down here in El Paso County. Looking forward to seeing you guys on Friday.
We'll see you Friday.
See you then. Thank you, guys. Vicki Tompkins.
Okay, bye-bye.
Can't buy tickets next year. You got to jump on it early.
Yeah.
When Mitt Romney. No, I'm kidding here. Yeah. And this from Mark. It's easier to pack the house without them than to get them there. Great reason for them to go away and stay away. There you go. All right, you guys. So that's going to do it for us today.
Yeah, that'll be it. And we'll be coming live from the event from 3 to 4. The event will be occurring a little bit later, but we'll hopefully. We're even trying to get Marjorie Taylor Greene. So
we're working it. We're working it.
So we appreciate everybody and have a great day. And it'll well be Party Friday next Friday.
That's right. Party Friday. We'll see you then. Thanks, everybody. Bye, everyone on Zoom.